Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that puts the crisis and challenges facing this so-called Republic of Opportunity under the microscope and asks, are there real solutions beyond the sound bites? We're the podcast of hope with ideas and policies for a caring republic. I'm Rory Hearn, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I'm good, Rory. How are you keeping? Can I just jump in very quickly and actually be very bold here and say, guys, while you're listening, try and head into the Patreon / Tortoise Shack, because just before we came on air, we were talking about the fact that that my poor wife was downstairs and we were trying to hide from her my credit card bill for the last amount of bandwidth that came out. But please do chip in if you can. Get us the price of a cup of coffee. Be great.
Yeah, no, it's something that we've been looking at over the last kind of few months as the podcast has taken off in terms of listenership. You know, we've thousands of listeners to every episode, but in terms of the technology, the use of the bandwidth to actually put this out, it's not viable financially. And personally, we're putting a huge amount of time. So we do need funding to keep going. So please go on and help us out. And now, otherwise, you will be listening to this podcast is brought to you by whoever. Yeah. And, you know, we also, if you know any sponsors, come on to us. But listen, on to what who we've got with us and what we're going to talk about. Colm O'Gorman, Executive Director of Amnesty International, Amnesty Ireland. Colm, it's great to have you in here.
Yeah, no, happy to be here, Rory.
Great.
Well, glad to finally get in.
Yeah, no, Colm, obviously, it's a long-running joke now about bumping into you in Trinity College and you recognising me for all the wrong reasons, but nonetheless, I managed to...
You were the fellow who was treating pictures of your manky toes for about a week before I met you for the first time, so like I couldn't, you know... You were kind of sticking them in people's faces, to be fair, Tony.
You can't troll a troll, you know?
Yeah. But Tony needs one of those filters on Twitter, you know? He needs to... I tried to say, Tony, send me your tweets before you tweet them, you know? We kind of need to do a filtering.
Ah, you don't have to be going there.
No, yeah, but no, I think you have to find your own voice,
yeah,
guys. We are here to talk about the rights-based society.
Yeah, and Colm, we wanted to start off with... Three things what do you think should be done if we were to make this a real republic of equality, and as Tony mentioned there, a rights-based republic?
Three things. Well, I suppose the first thing I think we should do is go back to founding principles and actually have a conversation about how and why we decided, or it was decided, that we should become a republic in the first place, and what does that mean? I mean, we live in a country where republic and republican have had lots of different meanings over the history of the state and even before the history of the state. So it'd be good to go back to understand what that means. I mean, I always remind myself that in reality, if we think about how this happens, so by an accident of geography and history, we've all ended up in this place. And over a period of millennia, we decided that actually, if we're going to live successfully or live as well as we can, we have to come up with some kind of contract about how we're going to live together.
Yeah.
So for me, underneath the very idea of a republic as a legal and political construct, it's something that's meant to provide a means through which we can live together, care for each other, provide for each other, support each other, and manage the way in which we're going to live together effectively. So for me, the very idea of a republic is grounded in that notion of mutual care, mutual respect, mutual regard, and mutual concern. The fact that, you know, the idea that we have both duties of care and responsibility to each other, and if we can frame those properly, we've a decent chance of making a shot at the thing. So the notion of a republic for me is grounded in a fairly basic concept of I suppose, love. It's most simple, love and mutual concern and care. And if we look at the things that underpin the founding of our republic, I mean, people dismiss, it always amazes me that people both dismiss the founding documents or principles that underpin the republic whilst they deify the blood sacrifice. You know, they want to get caught up in notions of martyrdom, but they don't want to talk about what were the principles that led to people being prepared to give their lives, you know, or risk their lives, or take enormous risks and pay huge costs.
But hasn't there been, throughout the state, the history of our state, this disconnect not only between those principles and the idea of the sacrifice and martyrdom, but the principles and the actual practice of governing, of living in a republic? And do you think that still continues today? Is there still...
Well, I think then you get to what slipped between principle and statehood. So what happened there? That's an interesting conversation. What were the forces that came into play between the establishment of the state it then becoming a republic. What happened, you know, in the fog and post the fog of a civil war? What were the powers that came to the ascendancy, and who did they serve, and who were they primarily interested in? And it's clear that they weren't concerned with those, the founding principles that we just spoke about. I mean, if you look at the proclamation, grounded in notions of equality and mutual concern and care. If you look at the programme for government of the First All, I mean, I remember writing about this in 2006 on the 90th anniversary. I did a thing for a project that SIPTU did called Liberty. And I pulled out that section that some Michael D quoted recently, that the president quoted recently, that the first obligation of the government of the republic shall be to guarantee the welfare of its children so that no child suffers from deprivation. You know, and they talked about lack of shelter or housing, etc. That was 1919. Mm. That was 7 decades before the international community came together and came up with the UN Declaration on the Rights of the Child. Mm. Like, it was nearly 5 decades before any of the major human rights treaties that set out those rights and obligations were put in place. It was 3 decades before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So here was this audacious little fledgling republic that was proclaiming itself and establishing its first doll, its first parliament, and saying that its first obligation were for the economic and social rights of what it saw as its most vulnerable citizens.
For a loving and caring republic from the outset.
But that's a really profound statement that's grounded in values. And those are practical. Those now have practical expression. We know what that means in law and how that would play out. But in this republic, we've done nothing but pay lip service to them. And, you know, I remember over the years when we've been campaigning on economic and social rights, you'd hear politicians and particularly political commentators in newspapers saying, but this isn't part of our political tradition. Mm. Social rights aren't part of our political tradition. Mm. And you point out the proclamation, the 1919 programme for government, or even Bunrock na hÉireann, the 1937 proclamation and the directive principles of social policy that set out very clearly that these should be the principles that direct social policy. Now, because this was a radical concept at the time, the Constitution didn't say that the court should be able to enforce these obligations on government, because it was anticipated that governments would respect what the Constitution said should direct social policies. Mm. But because they weren't enforceable, they were simply ignored. But it's untrue that these aren't part of our tradition. They are. Mm. You know,
even the rights, the article in relation to private property, Article 23, and it relates to that article should be tempered by the common
subject
good
to the common
subject
good
to so principles of social justice that even in that, you know, very the major problems within the 1937 Constitution, it's still outlined there that those values are there, and of course there's major issues. But you're right that those principles were there, and you know, in terms of, you know, what you've lived and your experiences, and you know, the reality of that kind of, as you've referred to, kind of that institutional oppression, do you think as a republic that we're healing?
I think we are in some regards. I think there are certain things that we've worked very hard to come to grips with. I'm actually really proud of the capacity that Irish society has shown to look at very dark aspects of our history and to own them in a way, actually, that I don't think the state at the official level ever really has. I mean, yes, we've seen state apologies, and we've seen meaningful speeches and heartfelt speeches at times from political leaders. But actually, at the level of the ordinary, of the everyday, the way in which people in Ireland understood what we collectively tolerated and permitted to happen to so many of us. Mm. Like, there isn't a family in this country that hasn't been touched by the kind of abuses that we've seen revealed over recent decades, or that hasn't felt that in some way. I mean, we live in a country, for God's sake, where at one point, when people were finally allowed access to contraception, only married couples could access condoms, and they had to be on prescription from their doctors. Mm. Like, that's how invasive and intrusive and abusive state's attitude to people and to people's lives, their sexual lives, their family lives, their reproductive lives were. Everybody understands to some degree the impact of a dogma-driven social policy and law. Mm. So we all know what that's like. And people understand and see, and I think have taken responsibility for, in an appropriate way, the way in which Irish society allowed itself to be so dominated by forces that were not just uncaring about appalling abuses and violations happening within their institutions, but in some ways invested in it. Mm. So I think that Ireland, as a people, we've really changed. As a people, we're really healing. And I think we saw that in you know, some of our recent referendums. You know, despite all of the stuff about the marriage equality referendum being, you know, we were told it was going to be really divisive and toxic and unpleasant. At times it absolutely was. And it's always very difficult for anybody to go out and have to go knocking door to door to try to say, can I please be treated with dignity? Can I please be granted equality in this republic? That's a difficult thing for people to do. And it was very painful for people, but it was also an extraordinary process at the end of which people danced in the streets for days.
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary thing. And then with the Eighth Amendment referendum as well, I mean, that was, for many of us who were very involved, an experience not to be repeated. It was brutal. It was brutalizing. It was awful. And the worst part of that is that it didn't have to be, because that's not where Ireland was. But it is where official Ireland, in terms of not even actually so much politics, but certainly media were. The way that debate was framed in the main was so toxic, was so unpleasant, was so unreasonable and so out of touch with where Ireland was, that it made it much more divisive and abusive and toxic than it
needed to be. There were op-eds calling for the toxicity before there was any toxicity in the debate.
Well, I mean, you know, for years we did polling in 2016, and a really, really extensive in-depth polling on public attitudes, not just to abortion, but to a whole load of allied issues. Like, for instance, we asked people, who do you trust as a source of information when making a decision about your personal position? And it was really revealing. I mean, it really surprised us what we saw. The second least trusted group were the media. Only 9% of people in Ireland in 2016 trusted the media as a source of information when it came to making a decision about their personal stance. They were less trusted than the church at 16%, or anti-abortion groups at 16%. The most trusted, interestingly, were doctors on 62% and women who've had abortions. So people... Ireland has shifted hugely, and I don't think Ireland has become something different. I think Ireland has finally become, we have become what we always were. We've just reclaimed our right to assert who we are and to have the conversations
that we need to have. But there are parts of it, and in a way it's I think it's important to see, or, you know, it's worth trying to discuss, and that the journey, we're still on the journey.
Absolutely.
That, you know, there's rights that have been achieved, you know, marriage equality, you know, bodily autonomy for women in terms of reproductive.
A large degree of bodily autonomy, but certainly not full body autonomy. Yeah, we have a long way to go there still, too.
Yeah, yeah. And there's major issues going on right now in relation to women's ability to access abortion clinics without, or not abortion clinics, but in terms of the service without facing the whole issue of protest been able to do that safely. But in terms of issues like that were set out in the proclamation, that were set out in the first around economic and social rights, that we look at the housing crisis affecting so many people, obviously homelessness being the most extreme end. We look at poverty, 230,000 children in poverty, inequalities, deep embedded absence of economic and social rights. And do you think that journey, we are still on the journey, or is there a certain level of people going, okay, we've achieved these kind of liberal social kind of freedoms and that, well, economic and social rights and inequalities, well, there's something else.
I think this is an area where there's a deep disconnect between how our political system thinks and operates and where public opinion or where public beliefs and values are at. Again, we did a lot of work on economic and social rights, and we'll be doing more into the future. Back in 2014, we campaigned to have the Constitutional Convention look at the question of strengthening ESC rights provisions at the level of the Constitution. And interestingly, again, before we head into that, we did some polling to just understand, if we come out and start talking, for instance, about the right to health and housing, do Irish people understand that that's a human right?
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. It was mid-80s percent of people, from memory, said that they believed the right to health was a fundamental human right, as important as fair trial rights, for instance.
Yeah.
And yet, if you say that, because I've said it to many policymakers and civil servants and political advisors and politicians over the last 10 years, they look at you and say, oh, but come on, they're not real rights now. That's not real stuff.
Yeah.
You know, what are you saying? That somebody can sue the government if they get sick, or if somebody doesn't have a house, they can go down to the High Court and be given a house. The lack of understanding about what economic and social rights, but economic and social and cultural rights generally mean at the level of our political system and at a civil service level is quite staggering. They honestly believe that if there's a right to housing in the Constitution, people who don't have a house can go and sue the state. Or that if there's a right to health, people who get sick will be able to sue the state. And that's a nonsense. That's not how this operates.
It comes back to that word, obligation. We talk about a country who finally was the last country to adopt the UN for Persons with Disabilities Act. But we didn't have the optional protocol because the state didn't want to do actually, again, the same fear of, well, if we don't actually enforce them, someone's going to go down to the courts and sue us to attest our rights. But we've spoken to Lalani Farah, the UN Special Rapporteur for Housing here, and she said if you can't attest the right, you don't have a right.
Exactly. Well, I'll give you a better one then. In 1989, we adopted the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which set out all of the rights that we've just talked about. Yeah. And by the way, the Constitutional Convention recommended by an overwhelming majority that the Constitution should reflect all of those rights, not one, not some, but all of the treaty rights. We still haven't ratified the optional protocol to that convention. And that's something we've been asking government to do for a very long time, to ratify the optional protocol, to sign up and ratify the optional protocol to the Convention on Economic and Social Cultural Rights. Because that would allow people who believe those rights have been violated to make a direct complaint to a treaty monitoring body, who could then make a recommendation or a finding to government. Now, by the way, Ireland can ignore a finding, even when it comes through the optional protocol, but it would be highly unusual for that to happen. These are mechanisms that are meant to assist states in delivering on their obligations and ensuring that they're properly protecting and fulfilling human rights.
It's worth going into, and I think it is, you know, every time we discuss this, because, you know, rights are, they're complex as well. While you say, okay, you've done surveys and there are surveys out there, and the most recent one done by the Irish Human Rights Commission showed a majority were in favour of the right to housing. But I think there's a real, you know, as you describe, lack of understanding amongst policymakers, also in the media as well, that there's this notion that rights is about free things. And it's worth breaking down, and maybe you could do for listeners in terms of, like, what are economic, social and cultural rights?
Well, let's talk about what they would result in. So if we had a right to housing, to health, to education, to work, to a decent standard of living in our constitution, what would it mean?
Yeah.
It would place a legal obligation on government to make decisions that were evidence-based, transparent and outcome-focused. So actually, what ESC rights in law require governments to do is to apply evidence-based, transparent, outcome-focused decision-making. And if the courts adjudicate on social rights generally, they don't look at you never see a court anywhere in the world, and many, many states, including European states, have social rights provisions in their constitutions, either explicitly or implied and therefore adjudicated through the courts. What they generally find is a process fault. In other words, the way that you made this decision was flawed. We're not going to tell you to go, you now need to spend 100 million more here, or you need to provide access to this. What they're saying is you didn't consider all of the available evidence. It wasn't a good process. It's an unreasonable decision. So they apply a reasonableness test to the decision. You need to go back and revisit this decision. So it requires good policymaking. It requires evidence-based, outcomes-focused policymaking.
But even to go back further and peel the onion another layer back, but even deeper, what are the principles? What are the values underpinning? Like, what is the right to housing? What is the
right to housing? So the right to housing means that, again, it places an obligation on the state to ensure that everybody has access to adequate shelter, and that the state does the best that it can within the resources that it has available to it to respect and to deliver that right. There are a couple of important principles around economic and social and cultural rights. First of all, the obligation on the state is limited to the maximum available resources. So obviously a state can't do what it doesn't have resources to do.
Yeah.
But there's also a requirement that it would progressively realise the right. So if we had the right to housing in law here tomorrow, it wouldn't mean that the next day the state had to fully deliver on the right to housing.
The state
would have to be able to demonstrate that it is gradually, progressively realising that right for people in a general sense, that the decisions that it's making are likely geared to provide the best possible housing outcome for the maximum number of people. So that's how it works. It's progressive realisation within the constraint of maximum available resources. And then critically, it says there really can't be any regression. You can't be stepping backwards. Unless you have no other option. Yeah. And again, you have to demonstrate that if you're going to degrade a right, if you're going to regress in any way, that you had no other option open to you, that you considered every other option, and this was the only thing that you could now do because of a major emergency or a lack of resources,
etc. Which is wonderfully linking into the evidence-based solutions that we like to talk about, because we know there are solutions that have worked globally. We know there are solutions that can be done more cost efficiently. And then when we look at something and like, say,
the solution's been implemented in this city right now, from a Coolon cooperative to
exactly
cost two, rental
two, to 2 kilometres up the road, there are houses built for 165,000.
Exactly. So again, evidence-based, outcomes-focused decision-making. We have this much money that we can allocate to delivering on the right to housing. Mm. So how can we allocate that most effectively to benefit the greatest number of people, recognising that there are vulnerable groups who need greatest protection and provision? So how do we do that? And then you have to be able to demonstrate publicly and clearly the evidence upon which you made your decisions. What's wrong with that? That's basically, it's a legal obligation on the state to apply good governance and good practice to how they develop policy and make decisions, and to do so transparently.
Which worries me, and I'm speaking in my own capacity here. This is not relating to your work, Colin, but we see the results of Rebuilding Ireland being hailed recently. As I saw in one article on RTE that they said they are exceeding their targets. It was mentioned twice, but every time I've gone through them, they're behind all their targets. The bills have not happened. They talk in terms of housing solutions, not in terms of housing built. We look at these numbers and you go, well, guys.
But also, what are we testing in the end? So when we establish targets, are they good targets? No. Are they minimal targets? Yeah. Are they the kind of targets? Are they appropriately and reasonably ambitious? Or are they developed to give the appearance of us achieving something? Now, I don't have the level of detail to adjudicate whether that's the case in those cases.
You could apply that directly to the housing assistance payment, that analysis. Mm. And if you look at the housing assistance payment, the government is using that and saying this is 17,000 of the 20,000 social housing solutions last year were housing assistance payment, which is housing accessed in the private rental sector, which does not give does not give security of tenure. That is, a private tenant who is getting a subsidy from the state to pay a landlord can be turfed out just as any other private any other tenant in the private rented sector. That's not social housing. Social housing is supposed to guarantee security of tenure. So its own, so it shouldn't be described as social housing.
And in a way, that goes on to, for me, make another evidence another critical point, and that is that it's never a great idea to look at an individual social economic right in isolation. Mm. So when you look at the right to housing, the right to housing is absolutely linked to a whole range of other rights, like the right to health, the right to education. And, you know, even when we look at what's happening now to people in homelessness, particularly people who are in hubs or in emergency accommodation, how is that impacting upon the right to health of their children, the right to education? It's clearly violating those rights too. So we have to look at all of these rights in the round. So if the government is going to say that it is entirely possible that a government could put in place housing provision that was direct payments to private landlords, but there would also need to be appropriate protections for tenants in that situation.
Yeah.
So if the mechanism through which it's delivering on housing through a direct payment to private landlords results in insecurity, in violations of other rights like education and a whole range of other social rights, then that's not good enough. And it's why, actually, we argue that, yes, we need to see the right to housing at the level of the Constitution, and we want to see that, and we're very supportive of that. But we actually think we need the full range of social rights to be properly protected, so that you also don't see a skewing of obligation and a skewing of focus into one area to the detriment of another area. All social rights are, all rights actually, all human rights are interdependent. And they need to be seen and recognised as such, and government needs to have an obligation to deliver and protect on all rights for all people.
And just on that, in terms of the Constitution, because there is increasing, and and others are articulating the idea that we should have a constitutional referendum around the right to a home, and that there is a moment now, given the crisis that's going on, people are seeing we need to mark an end point, we need to culturally change how we have a conversation about housing, how housing is treated as it should be a right rather than this asset dominated. That if you look at the learnings from the Together for Yes campaign and the marriage equality, that this kind of national conversation piece is required about housing.
Well, I mean, first of all, we've had a constitutional convention on economic, social and cultural rights, and it made a massive recommendation to government that those rights should be better protected at the level of the constitution. That was also recommended by earlier committees that looked at constitutional reform. So we've had a number of reports that said we need strength, we need these rights strengthened to the level of the constitution. If what the government wants to do now is have another citizens assembly where they look at how would they give positive let's drill down into that and see how we would do it, that could be useful. But you know, the outgoing government, pretty much on the last couple of days of government, finally responded to that recommendation very late of the Constitutional Convention. And they said that an Oireachtas committee in the incoming Dáil would look at the issue. And then they stuck it into the Special Committee on Housing and it got very little attention.
And now it's so, put off to the Finance Committee as far as I'm aware.
So actually, I absolutely agree we need to have a big conversation, but we've had big conversations. What we actually need is to do something here. And, you know, again, one of the things that I've said repeatedly to politicians, to ministers and to advisors has been, just reflect back a little bit here now. Think back to the beginnings of the so-called economic crisis, the crash, the massive crash. Think back to those conversations with the IMF and the ECB and the Troika. Let's imagine a government that could have said to those international bodies, absolutely, we recognise that we're going to have to cut back on expenditure very, very significantly. Absolutely, we hear you say that we're going to have to meet obligations, whether they exist or not, to bondholders and junior bondholders. But by the way, we have binding constitutional obligations to people living within the state as well. And we cannot negatively impact on areas like health or housing or education unless we have no other option.
Funnily enough,
and we have to be able to evidence that. Imagine if part of that conversation had been, yes, absolutely, we'll make the changes that are necessary, but legally, we absolutely cannot make changes that negatively impact upon people's rights to housing, health or education unless we have no other choice. And by the way, junior bondholders don't come before that.
And actually, Colin,
and can't.
There's nothing in EU law that dictates that the state can't act to defend its citizens.
Yeah, of course.
And with that sentence, that very sentence, if you recall, when Spain coloured outside the lines as well, they received a fine of, I think it was 1.2 billion, and they sent back and said, nope, we're not paying. And the EU came back and said, well, we'll do a deal with you. We'll give you a slap on the wrist. And I think now I'm right in saying that there was a swear word used going back from the Department of Finance in Spain, in other words, and it all went away quietly.
But even step back a level and just think about that conversation when the then Fianna Fáil independent government was sitting down with the Troika. And if they're saying, absolutely, we can talk about the kind of cuts and expenditure that need to happen, but there's a baseline beneath which we cannot go legally or constitutionally. That is not permissible by law. We can't go below that baseline.
And even as important, that conversation they would be having with the IMF would be the conversation they would be having with the Irish people.
Oh, yeah.
As in, if we had those rights in the constitution, that's why I think that the process of achieving those rights is important as well. And while you were saying that, yes, the conversation has been had around the convention, but I still think there is a national conversation needed around economic and social and cultural rights that people go, yeah, this is the type of country we want.
I agree completely. Yeah, no, absolutely I agree. I mean, that's the way to affect this kind of change. But again, I suspect that just like we saw with marriage equality, just like we saw with the Eighth Amendment, the people are pretty much there. It's absolutely likely the case that there's more information that's needed so that people fully understand. But the thing that I keep learning in this job is we shouldn't underestimate the cop-on and common sense of the average person. They're often very far ahead of policymakers, of politicians and of media on these issues. And I think they are on this as well. It makes sense to people. I mean, how could it not make sense to people that government should be obliged to make decisions that are in the public good, that they should be prepared to account for those decisions, that they should be able to show the evidence that underpinned their decision-making when it comes to how they're spending our money, how they're providing public services and how they're taking care of all of us, but also the most vulnerable. How is that not sensible? Most people get that. And that's what ESC rights in law would mean fundamentally.
And do you see Amnesty having a role in progressing that?
Economic, social, cultural rights is a major priority for us. I mean, in a way, we were maybe a little bit ahead of the curve back in because we started working on health and housing rights in 2008, at a time when those things weren't being talked about, and at a time when people were saying, "Well, we have an economic crisis; we can't be talking about that." And what we were saying was, "It's exactly it's when we need to be talking about it." When you have less money and you have much more difficult decisions to make, then you need to think about the framework through which you're making those decisions. What's the process that you apply when you're making tough decisions in times when you have less money? That's when we need that kind of framework available to us. And then in 2013 and 14, when we got that recommendation from the convention. So absolutely, we intend, and we'll be talking to other partners working in the area over the next little while as well, to be pushing for that bigger conversation. We want to see economic, social and cultural rights fully protected at the level of the Irish Constitution. We've been calling for it for years. We want to see how we can increase our work in that area, and we want to see it happen.
When, very good. When you bring that out, you broaden that out, and you talk about that conversation that didn't happen. So central governments across the globe didn't sit down with whoever it was that, you know, whether it was the global financial crisis, and they, you know, decisions were made where banks were bailed out and companies were bailed out globally. And we then see now we're reaping the rewards where the polarization has happened, the rise of the right. We're talking about a very changed European Parliament in the next coming months. There's talks of, you know, the dynamic shifting in there. And you see that and you realize that that kind of, we sowed the seeds for that by not actually putting that baseline in place for people. We're not giving people protections of human rights. You've recently returned from the Mexico-US border. You're seeing this play out firsthand. Do you see it actually turning at all, or is it getting worse? Like, Ireland stands out kind of as, we haven't seen as much of that, but we've seen some traces of the ugly face of this rising. But it's, you know, it's getting more popular now to be able to say these things and be a jerk, basically.
There's so much stuff to unpick in that, right? Yeah. So I mean, the notion that, first of all, I mean, the part that cracks me up completely is this narrative that comes out from people. You saw it during the presidential campaign, that there are things you can't say anymore. Like, we're sick of the things that, like, what can people not say? If you think about some of the things that have been said in national media and repeated in opinion pieces across our media constantly over the last little while, if you think the things that we're seeing that are being said internationally about people of colour, about LGBT people, about migrants, about refugees, about women, about travellers in this country.
The President of the United States implemented a Muslim ban.
Yeah. Like, what are the things that we can't say anymore? How much bigotry, how much misogyny, how much homophobia, how much xenophobia, how much racism do we have to see before we stop with this nonsense of, oh, you can't say, or you just can't say anything more because political correctness has gone mad? Like, it's a nonsense. The real question we need to be asking is, why do you believe that, and why do you want to say it? I think we need to have a conversation. There's no point in us just shouting racist at anybody, but we need to have a conversation about that, that says, why are you saying that? But actually, more importantly, I think we need to unpick the idea that the victims of racism are racists, right? That actually it's a greater injury to accuse somebody of being a bigot than to practice and exercise bigotry. And we have to normalize conversations around prejudice. Like, the notion, for instance, that I can't wrap my head around how the idea of challenging somebody for a view that's homophobic is a huge insult. Like, I've been incredibly homophobic in my life. I remember after the Pantygate thing, writing a piece, and I sent it in somewhere and they printed it, and the headline I put on it and they kept it was, I'm homophobic and so is my husband. Because the point that I was making it was, you can't grow up in a society without taking in the ingrained prejudice and biases that exist within that society. You just can't. We all grow up taking on board and holding and expressing deeply held ingrained prejudices. I have been xenophobic, racist, misogynistic, ableist, homophobic, transphobic. I've been all of these things at various points in my life. And I'm sure that there are still prejudices that play out in how I think and how I see the world. But I'm open to acknowledging that. That's the thing that we have to get to. We have to get to a point where we're prepared to own and understand our own prejudices, and to see that that's the thing we need to investigate and interrogate rather than, you know, defend against an accusation. Prejudice is normal.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because it is looking as well deeper at the reasons behind why this, you know, this the emergence of the far right, the bigotry, you know, the insecurities that lie behind that. And it is
they've managed to weaponize that incredibly well. What populist extreme right forces have managed to do over the last number of years is to exploit people's ingrained prejudices, to tell them that it's okay, that how they feel and what they think is okay, that it's fine to discriminate against particular groups of people based on just aspects of their identity or who they are. That's okay. That's reasonable. And you're right, by the way, it's their fault that your standard of living has gone down. It's their fault that your government isn't providing for a framework within which your dignity and your rights are properly respected. It's not our fault. It's not political leaders' fault. It's not hugely wealthy elites' fault. It's the fault of migrants or of gay people or of marginalized women or of refugees that your life isn't good.
Yeah.
Even in places where there are no migrants, there are no refugees, you know, where these aren't issues.
And the
at
only
all.
Time they punch up is to use the awful anti-Semitism that creeps in. It becomes a globalist cabal. And you're going,
well, I mean, you know, when you see who's leading the charge in most countries, they are incredibly wealthy people. Mm. I mean, to see suddenly the notion that Jacob Rees-Mogg, whose father literally wrote a book about how to monetize chaos, how to monetize and profit from financial and economic chaos, Boris Johnson and a whole range of other Brexiteers, hugely wealthy, hugely privileged individuals, suddenly they are the ones who are standing by the marginalized and challenging elites. Mm. Like, it's a very neat trick, but they've managed to pull it off by exploiting this notion that prejudice is perfectly right and reasonable, and that you're right to be angry. You just need to be angry with them, not with us, whilst they screw us all constantly behind the scenes.
And isn't the part of that story very much the failure of alternative politics, the failure of what might be called the social democratic or broad left to speak to people who are marginalized over the last 30 years?
I think there's been an extraordinary arrogance, or not arrogance, as well, some arrogance, but mainly complacency and self-satisfaction on the part of many people, including, by the way, human rights organizations like Amnesty, who said, oh no, we've defended that. That'll never happen.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you look at the narrative in the UK and in other countries, and people who held strong progressive values, whether they were human rights based or progressive, whatever else, felt we've won that one now. That won't happen here. Yeah. That won't happen here. We're immune to that. Nobody is immune to that.
Mm.
So, you know, there's a significant level of complacency that's also responsible for where we have gotten to. And I mean, I remember being at a meeting of Amnesty colleagues, fellow directors from around Europe, and it was in the Netherlands. And my colleague, who's the director of Amnesty in the Netherlands, there had just been an election and there'd been a big shift and some of the populists had come in, and he said, we're going to have to get used now here to having a government that doesn't agree with 95% of what we say. And it was a shock to people that this had happened.
Yeah.
You know, there was too many people, too many of us who were asleep at the wheel for too long and who believed that we'd won the argument and that we could just talk at a certain level without engaging at a deeper level with the malaise, with the things that were happening within our societies.
Yeah.
And Amnesty, by the way, for a very long time, didn't talk about economic and social rights.
Yeah.
We didn't go near those issues. We focused, and in a way it's understandable, we were founded out of a civil and political rights concern and focus. But there was a long conversation over a decade or more in Amnesty about moving into working on full spectrum rights and economic and social cultural rights. It took us a long time to do it, and we should have done it an awful lot
sooner.
But
the EU itself even didn't look at the crisis of the last decade. They produced the Future of Europe paper, and the Future of Europe paper, through all the scenarios, there was very little in terms of, you know, protections for individuals. For it was very little human rights. There was trade mentioned in every scenario. There was security mentioned in every scenario. There was borders mentioned in every single scenario. Even when they said we're going to do less integration, we're still going to talk security and trade.
Well, the whole focus on borders, for instance, was on throwing up walls. It was on Fortress Europe rather than in approaching issues around migration and international protection in a way that was grounded in European law and European principles. So they set aside the law completely and threw up borders. Like, what's been happening in the Mediterranean for nearly a decade now isn't the inevitable result of conflict in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in famine, in deprivation, in poverty in other parts of the world. It's an inevitable consequence of decisions made by the EU. And remember, when we say the EU, we're talking about its states, including Ireland, to throw up walls and shut down pathways to safe and legal protection and migration for people in a managed way. And that's why we saw these so-called uncontrolled flows. Mm. That's why we saw the massive rise in people smuggling and another criminal activity. Like, the EU decries people smugglers. It created their market. It is directly responsible for creating the market for people smugglers. Mm. And now it's, you know, when it signed an obscene deal a couple of years ago with Turkey to shut down the route from across from Turkey to Greece, the Aegean Sea, we said at the time the one thing that will inevitably follow from this is people will now, desperate people who see no other option, will now be forced to go down and across Libya and transition from Libya. And it will be much worse. And the kinds of human rights violations that we're going to see as a consequence of that will be horrific. We're seeing rape, murder, slavery, of migrants and refugees in Libya, the death rate has gone up. In 2018, there were fewer people who took the crossing, but one in six people died. In 2017, it was one in 14.
The
death rate in the Mediterranean, based on the you know, relevant to the numbers who are crossing, is going up, and the EU has withdrawn completely from that. I mean, right now, the last year, the EU designated a particular area within the Mediterranean as a Libyan search and rescue zone. It happens to be, coincidentally enough, the zone where the area where most shipwrecks happen. They then gave resources to the Libyan Coast Guard, and Libya doesn't have a unified government. It doesn't have a functional system to patrol that area. They pulled back their own navies from patrolling that area. They're trying to prevent NGO ships from taking to sea to try to rescue people who are being shipwrecked in that area. If there were, there was a case in two cases in December last year of two NGO ships who did two rescues. When they contacted the European authorities in both Malta and Italy, which were the countries closest to the shipwrecks, or the countries in which they were flagged, which was Germany and the Netherlands, one was told, don't rescue the people, contact the Libyan Coast Guard, which, by the way, would be breaking international law. There's an obligation if you see a shipwreck to come to people's rescue. The other was told to offload the people and hand them over to the Libyan Coast Guard, which would see them return to Libya, which also is illegal under international law, because that would mean returning people to a place where we know they're going to experience torture, rape, slavery, and massive human rights violations. Those are the EU's policy decisions today, and they are in no way a reflection of either EU values or EU law. And, you know, I believe in the notion of Europe. I believe in the EU in terms of its founding principles and what it's meant to do. But it's deeply, deeply flawed. I mean, there is no provision in the EU really at all to hold EU member states to account for complying with European law. You mentioned human rights. If you look at the process of ascension for any state that wants to join the EU, there's a massive focus, for instance, on its human rights record and its human rights frameworks and institutions and laws, up to the moment it becomes a member of the EU. The moment it's a member, there is no examination at all.
Which is hilarious, because we've tutted at Turkey for two decades about their, you know, winking at Germany about perhaps coming into the EU, and we've managed to outsource a lot of our dirty deeds.
Now we need to do more than tut-tut with Turkey, considering what's going on there.
Absolutely, but you understand my point.
Absolutely.
It's at that stage where it goes back to, and I always repeat it, the Arundhati Roy, that, you know, the lifestyle wars that are fought outside of Fortress Europe in the US that keep us in the style of.
And I mean, you mentioned the trip to Mexico, US, and I mean, what we saw there was awful. But I'll tell you one thing: Europe has nothing to teach the EU, and I wouldn't want Europe to be teaching anything the EU about border issues or migration, border issues or migration. I mean, the EU is infinitely worse than what's happening on the Mexico border. Now, what's happening on the Mexico border is awful. When you come away from it, the thing that you're struck with most here is this is an entirely manufactured crisis. And even if you look at the numbers, like one of the first border crossing points we went to was called San Isidro, which is a crossing point from Tijuana into the San Diego area. And every day, over 200,000 people go over and back across that border legally. The Mexican authorities told us about 9 million border crossings, legal border crossings happen there every day, or every year, And the caravans that President Trump has been raising Mary Hell about in the media over the last 9 months. So the first arrived last November. There's another that hasn't quite arrived yet there, even though it was on its way when we were there a couple of weeks ago. If you inflate the figures as much as you can, how many people do you imagine will have arrived in Tijuana between those two caravans over that period from November until now? What do you think?
4,700.
It's about 12,000, maybe 15,000 maximum. But if you think about that in terms of 200,000 people a day crossing over the border legally, on the US side, there, Customs and Border Patrol, who literally their only responsibility is Customs and Border Patrol and control. On the California side of that, have 5,800 officers. The Mexicans have about 280 on their side of it, by the way. But those are they're now being supplemented by troops and by other law enforcement agencies. To manage what? The idea that 12,000 people might, over a period of 6 months, present themselves at the border and legally and lawfully apply for international protection or asylum. Like, there is not a security crisis. There is a humanitarian crisis, but it's been created by Trump and the Trump administration. And to be clear about one thing, it didn't start with him. Like, the Obama administration was not good on this issue. The Obama administration introduced laws and policies that violated rights and that were entirely wrong. But Trump has put them on steroids. Mm. I mean, what Trump and his administration are doing now is really shocking. Whilst we were there, there was a draft US memo that was revealed by a university there that showed that the intention of policymakers was to, and I quote, traumatize children on the southern border to create a humanitarian crisis. Mm. Mm. Like, that was the intention. So this is a manufactured crisis that's about appealing to a populist approach to inflaming a base in the interests of achieving and then hanging on to power.
Project fear.
It's project fear. It's project hate. Mm. Mm. And we see that in Europe as well, in Orban in Hungary.
Yeah.
I mean, a few years ago, remember, we were seeing on Europe's borders refugees who were fleeing Islamic State and the Assad regime. You know, the big bogeymen of our modern era. And they are horrific forces. Mm. We saw people fleeing those being met with what on Europe's borders? A managed process to grant them protection and to think about their humanitarian needs. No, razor wire, water cannon, tear gas, and baton charges.
Cameramen kicking them, if you remember.
Cameramen. But I mean, even I remember in 2015 when we were pushing the EU to go back to look at humanity, to try to restore humanitarian search and rescue missions in the Mediterranean. David Cameron standing up in the House of Commons and saying that we won't contribute to humanitarian search and rescue missions because it would be a pull factor. Mm. Now, if you think about what that means, what was he saying? What he was actually saying was, no, we don't want to rescue people, because if we rescue people, it might convince a few people that it's a risk worth taking. What does that actually mean? It means we need to let people drown in the Mediterranean to teach a lesson to people who might consider coming. Yeah. That's Europe. Those are our values. That's what we were meant to be founded upon.
And it's deeply, you know, and you can look at it in one sense, you could be deeply pessimistic about this and look at where things are heading, the direction, and they clearly are heading in quite a, and you know, and currently the humanitarian disasters that are going on. So the questions then come up in terms of hope, and the question comes up in terms of what can people do. And as far as I could see, there is a dynamic around, you know, hope lies in citizens engaging in social movements to try and change this, in progressive politics, like you say, organizations going, actually, we need to go back in a way and look at economic rights, the people who feel excluded. There is a strong element of economic inequality, economic exclusion that we need to, the left needs to stand up and start asserting and defending. But in terms of, I think, if we look at the climate, for example, the climate movement, the climate strike of students, we're very much, you know, you could describe it as polarizing, but there is real hope, I think, in social movements and citizens engaging in a progressive politics. Would you agree, or what do you think?
Oh, completely. Look, the one thing that some would say ridiculously hopeful, but it's because actually the thing I've learned and I've seen all through my life is that if we can reveal the nature of a wrong, there's something in our humanity that compels us to respond to it. So I always feel that if we haven't managed to break through in confronting something that's so clearly wrong, it's because we're not doing our jobs properly. We're not communicating that properly. We're not revealing that properly to people. Because my experience is whenever we present it clearly, calmly, reasonably, powerfully, if we can tell the story, if we can reveal what's happening, the decency that lies at the heart of our humanity compels us to respond positively. Like, I saw that when I first became active, you know, in my late 20s and trying to confront issues around sexual abuse within the Catholic Church, you know, and that was at a time in Ireland where, you know, when you spoke about these things, you got death threats. And I got those early on. Or where, you know, when you said that the state needs to investigate how and why abuse was allowed to happen within Catholic dioceses in these countries with impunity, and it didn't even seem to, never mind prevent it, but properly investigate it or address it. And we were told that, well, the Constitution means that the state can't investigate the church as if somehow the rape and abuse of children is a central tenet of any faith.
Yeah.
Or how canon law is superior to civil law, or how, no, you can't go there. Or like, all of that stuff happens. But why did we break through there? It wasn't just because people like me spoke out. Our voices were really important. It was actually because people listened and people got angry and people said, we won't accept this and we won't tolerate this. The terrible things that happen in the world happen because we tolerate them. And it really is this simple. We have to stop tolerating them and we have to start saying no more. And particularly in countries where we have what is now sadly a privilege, the privilege of having power, democratic power. We have to own that power. We have to take responsibility for it. And by God, we have to start to exercise it. Mm. And when we do, everything changes. You know, people look at Ireland internationally now and I was having a conversation with a Dutch journalist yesterday and they keep asking the same question about how has Ireland become something different? And we have not become something different. We've become more of who we actually are, who we have always been. We have understood and reclaimed our capacity to say who we are and to assert who we are and to manifest who we are and to demand and require that our laws and our politics reflect that. And we've done it on issues that we were told we could never talk about or that didn't matter. Like 15 years ago, a then senior government minister was telling me that in Ireland we're pathologically incapable of having an objective conversation about abortion. Well, that was bullshit, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, our media might be, but even our political system wasn't. Look at the Committee on the 8th. Mm. A phenomenal piece of political work. Just extraordinary. Yeah. Politicians who did us proud. Who did their jobs and did them brilliantly. Look at the Citizens' Assembly. Citizens who came together when politics couldn't and had a really profound conversation and made really sensible, solid recommendations and decisions on back of it. And look at the Irish people and what they did. Like the RTÉ exit poll, I get emotional thinking about the first time I saw the RTÉ exit poll, when it said that 62% of people decided to vote yes on the basis of what? A woman's right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
And like for 5 years, I had journalists and political correspondents and some politicians saying to us, Irish people are not pro-choice. We're never going to go there. Mm. You had people saying that the recommendation on access upon request in early pregnancy was just way too radical and way too far for Irish people. Bullshit. It wasn't. Mm. Actually, support for that recommendation went up during the referendum. Yeah. Critically, the exit poll also told us that 72% of people, I think it was, hadn't changed their position on abortion in 5 years.
Mm.
And that 82% of people had decided their vote before the referendum campaign proper started about this time last year. So, like ordinary people, when we decide in our republic to assert our values and to demand that our politics and our law and our government practice those values, we are capable of driving huge change. We are privileged in that. But we'll lose it if we don't use it.
Mm.
And we've seen that happen in too many other countries. Because when democracy starts to break down, it's because of a disconnect between the system and the people. And that means that the system is ignoring the people, but also as people, we're tolerating it. So the key is not to tolerate it. And that changes everything. Yeah. Absolutely everything.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really powerful and profound. And it is, you know, you were describing there what you said, you know, you feel emotional. You're getting emotional. You're emotional all the time. And we all are. And I think it's important that, because it comes back to when you say about opening up and revealing, in a way, we're becoming more human and we're coming back to being what humans are, which are vulnerable people who live together and ultimately are about trying to figure out the best way that we can care for each other.
Yeah,
and
yeah, we're,
and
what we're vulnerable.
Is politics removes emotions. Politics, it focuses on very negative emotions rather than actually promoting the caring side of us.
We're seeing politics now in some parts of the world that exploit negative emotion. They exploit fear to provoke hate and distrust and division.
Some of it here.
Right? So that's what they do. And we do see it here as well. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. We see too much of it here. Not as much as we see in other places, but we're certainly not immune to it. And we need to recognize that and we need to act to prevent that from happening more here in the future because we're not immune to it. And I agree that we are all inherently vulnerable. Like to be alive is to be vulnerable.
Exactly.
But we're also extraordinarily passionate. Like I really believe that at the heart of humanity is just such decency, such integrity, such a capacity for love and positive expression. Like if you think about it in the most logical way, like life always seeks to manifest itself in the healthiest possible way. When you see a seed land in a crack in a wall and somehow something manages to grow out of it and grow towards the sun, that's life doing what life does. It's trying to find positive, healthy expression. And our humanity is the same. So I think we need to trust ourselves an awful lot more, but that also means then taking responsibility for what's happening around us and key, not tolerating injustices wherever and we see them.
Using our own power, each individual's power to speak up and then to speak up collectively.
Yeah.
And
the kind of violations that we see, even if they don't affect us, even if we think they don't affect us directly, they do. Because those kind of violations degrade us all. They degrade our society, they degrade us as a people, they degrade our humanity. And we have a personal stake in that. The joyous part of it all is that actually, you know, as we've seen in Ireland in recent years, when we connect with that space within ourselves, within our society and within each other, we do really profound things.
Yeah.
I mean, just think back to, you know, for me, 2015, but we saw it again last year. At the end of a democratic process in Ireland in 2015 and 2018, people were dancing with joy in the streets. Mm. And they weren't dancing with joy in the streets in 2015 because, you know, my marriage to my husband was now legal in Ireland.
Yeah.
That wasn't what it was about. And they certainly weren't dancing with joy in the streets last year because now women would have abortions. They were dancing with joy in the streets because we were expressing something about the kind of society we are, that we are a society that wants to be and that is committed to values of compassion, of love, of mutuality, of concern, of regard, of equality, of rights, of dignity. And when we give expression to that, and we had a conversation that allowed us to manifest that, that was a joyous thing.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that if we make the right decisions politically, in a whole range of areas, we'll be dancing in the streets every day. But by God, we'll have reasons to celebrate. And we'll do good things. We'll do good things. We might even become the republic that we were always meant to be. And that'd be something.
Great. Colm, listen, that was really powerful. We'll leave it there. I think there's a lot of hope, a lot of potential. We're on the journey. Let's keep going. We can get there to that republic.
And I want to say thank you very much for coming in. I hope everybody understands that there is hope. There is optimism. We do talk about solutions, but when you think about putting people at the heart of things, compassion and love, those words people say, someone said to me recently, that's wishy-washy. I said, absolutely not. Wishy-washy would mean that I wouldn't be putting these things out into the world to try and actually broaden these conversations to make sure people can open their minds to seeing it. And then, you know, and then actually leading the politicians, leading them to say, well, actually, we need to do something about direct provision, leading them to...
You're going to kill me now because you guys were trying to wrap up. But I have to say one other thing, because you were asking about practical things, right? We have to identify practical things that people can do to make things better, right? So get involved in issues if you care about them. Like, that's one of the ways you can make change. But when you talk about refugees and what we can do in this country, and if we look at really flawed systems that we've used up at this point, for instance, around direct provision, we've been working for the past nearly 2 years now to put in place a model of community sponsorship for refugees in Ireland. In May of 2017, we met with government for the first time. We'd looked at a model that's in place in Canada, where since 1979, they've resettled 300,000 people, not just through their government scheme. Their government scheme did that and more, but through a scheme that they call private sponsorship. And it means that a local community, a group comes together and they receive and resettle a refugee or refugee family and are their best friends and mentors and mates and neighbours for at least the first year of their time in their new country to make sure that they have a really good experience and that they settle in well. We asked the Irish government to look at doing that. In September of 2017, they committed to it. Last year, they further committed to it, and the whole policy framework has now been agreed. The first family actually arrived as part of a pilot program for that in December of last year, and the full program will be launched in the next month or so. That's going to offer an opportunity for people to come together and literally to organise themselves into local groups to apply to become sponsors for a refugee family. It will mean that when a refugee family arrive here, you know, who've spent 5 years in Lebanon, terrified and not able to go back to their homes in Syria, where they finally decided now they need to relocate and resettle somewhere else, they won't be met by immigration officials. They'll be met by their sponsor group and their new best friends at the airport, brought to their new home and helped to settle into their new area and their new lives. They'll have friends who will be wrapped around them for their first year. That's something that people can do. There's a huge appetite for that here, and that's going to be launched over the next little while. So there's lots of things we can do at the local, at the individual level that are very real and practical. Like, I remember a few years ago, people contacted me about Syria and going, but what can we do? It all feels so hopeless and helpless. And this program is running in a number of different parts of the world, and Amnesty is promoting it in lots of different countries as well. There's a phenomenal quote from a sponsor, a woman who leads a sponsor group in Fishguard. And she said, somebody said to me once, what you're doing is just a drop in the ocean. And she said, but the ocean is made up of drops.
Very good. Yeah.
No, there is. And, you know, there's other things as well. There's a Raise the Roof, for example, have an online petition that they're looking for people to sign in support of the government to actually start building public affordable housing and for the right to housing. And there's also a march in Cork, been organised by the Right to Housing on Saturday, March 9th. So there's lots of things people
get involved, get engaged.
Yeah. You know, we can do it.
Thanks for listening, folks. Do us a favour again. Help us out. Buy us a cup of coffee on Patreon. Talk to you all soon. Take care.